Hello and welcome back to Deadwired, where we break down everything dead-related with expert insights. I'm Elina Halkia. Today we're diving into the evolving space of private credit at a quite uncertain time for leveraged finance. With markets rattled by President Trump's tariff announcements, volatility is back, and so are recession fears. Risk assets are wobbling, deal flow has slowed, and many investors are stepping to the sidelines, waiting to see how it all plays out. I'm now joined by Mike Ewald, Bain Capital's head of private credit, to unpack how one of the biggest players in the space is navigating this moment. Mike, great to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Always happy to talk with Deadwire.
That's great to hear. So let's first start with your positioning. Given everything that's going on right now, how are you adjusting your investment strategy, if at all?
It's a very involved question. There's a lot in there, right? Certainly, you mentioned tariffs in your introduction, and that's certainly one of our concerns. But look, ultimately, we have the luxury of being long-term investors. We have a long-term capital base. Our investments tend to be senior secured loans with maturities 5 to 7 years, so we can afford to be patient in a lot of ways. So we do want to be careful that we're not just reacting to the latest tweet or headline. Now, having said that, of course, it is important to respond to current market conditions. But I think responding versus reacting is the key point there. So tariffs are the obvious one. They do impact, I think, the entire market, but our market segment in that core middle market maybe to a lesser degree. But we're focused on more like the knock-on effects of tariffs and some of the other Trump policies right now, like mass deportations, a huge reduction in the federal workforce. There's a massive tax cut to be paid for, and what those impacts will be on inflation and unemployment. So we do think it's more likely than not that there's going to be a recession. So when you think about new deals, you think about positioning, our base underwriting case today is not simply a haircut of management's growth case. It's much more of a full-on recession case. And there's certainly some obviously impacted industries, like anything consumer-related that might be coming from abroad. In the first Trump administration, the concern was China tariffs. Now it's potentially tariffs against everybody in China and in Europe and everywhere else in the world. And anything that might have steel or aluminum, or that's a pharma or a chemical type product, we're not particularly bullish about the U.S. consumer today. So we're also staying away from a lot of U.S. consumer facing businesses.
But overall, you're still deploying capital, right? It's not like you're pulling back by...
Correct. We're still finding interesting opportunities. I'd say there's a couple of places. One is add-ons to existing portfolio companies. It's no secret that private equity sponsors are holding on to their portfolio companies a lot longer and looking to see how they can grow them until the market to sell them is a little bit more robust. So that's certainly one example. Look, another one is that we have stayed to this core middle market that we've talked about before. And while a lot of our peers have left that market, we're still there. And so it's become an even broader opportunity set for us because we have different sponsors, different companies calling us that wouldn't have called us before because they may have been banked by someone else. Finally, we're also very active internationally as well. So we're not just focused on the U.S. About 30% of our book is over in Europe. That's the majority of that piece. And then there's also some in Australia and New Zealand as well.
And you mentioned your focus on the core middle market. What advantages does this provide? I guess you're staying there while others are going to the upper middle market.
We're staying there. And again, here we have a little bit of a luxury. We're not a publicly traded GP. Yes, sometimes you can be a little more focused on AUM growth and raising the next big fund if that's what Wall Street is asking of you. But for us, it's really a matter of where's the best risk return trade-off, and that's where we can invest our capital and then bring some limited partners and other investors along for that ride. So we're not looking to grow for growth's sake like some of our peers are. And so we've been able to stay in this core middle market. And the reason we think it's better is for a few reasons. You know, first of all, you might hear bigger is better, and that's why some of our peers have moved up market. This is always, or I make the joke that that's not always true. Ask the captain of the Titanic. Didn't work out too well for him at the time, right? So certainly scale matters. You do need to matter in your ecosystem. Every investment committee we have, the team's always prepared to answer a question that I'll pull out every once in a while, which is, does anybody care if this company goes away? Sounds like a very pithy question, but it's actually a great screen for credit. And once you've gotten to that scale, you know the company has a reason for being and you can be comfortable investing with it. And then in terms of why that ends up being more interesting then is a few things. One is there's an illiquidity premium associated with that segment. So if you think about the broadly syndicated loan market, today's market might be 300 or 400 basis points over SOFR. The upper middle market, where a lot of our peers have moved, might be 50 basis points wide of that. We're typically 150 to 200 points wide of that. So if you think about that return part of it, it's actually very interesting. On the risk part, we think there's a few different advantages. One is documentation's a lot better. You typically control your tranche. So we're generally the majority holder of our tranches. So we can demand documentation that includes financial covenants, for example. We tend not to over-lever our companies in the larger cap space. You might see optional PIK interest. And that is often the case because the company simply can't afford that level of debt. So, and I think there's a few different structural reasons why it's a much more attractive market.
And I did want to ask you, in the current market environment right now, how are you thinking about pricing and portfolio resilience?
Yeah, there's almost two questions there, right? From a pricing perspective for new deals, what I would tell you probably about 6 months ago is there wasn't much difference between the kind of A plus deal and a deal that might not be quite as strong. What you're seeing in today's market is that the AA plus deal is still fairly heavily competed. So I'd say pricing's still fairly tight there. But there is more of a bifurcation now where quality is really coming into play. And that B or B minus deal, which might be perfectly appropriate, is just priced wider now. So you can see pricing gapping out maybe 50 basis points for a deal like that. I think we are being smart as an industry there. And from a portfolio resilience perspective, that's always tough looking into the future, right? I think the last blip we've had for our portfolio companies was about 12, 18 months ago when you saw the full LTM flow through of higher base rates. And how is that going to impact liquidity of our portfolio companies having to pay a much higher interest burden? They've gotten through that pretty well. And I think that they're pretty primed for some growth there. Certainly rates came down a little bit last year. I think that helped ease some of that burden on there. But generally speaking, our companies are, I think, poised particularly well right now, even with some recessionary concerns across the board.
Have you ever had to walk away from any deals because the pricing didn't justify the risk?
Yeah, look, certainly pricing, we can get beat up pretty badly from private equity sponsors and from management teams. It's hard to take pricing just in isolation. You know, there's things like how tight's the documentation, how much leeway is there in the financial covenant, for example, what sort of restrictions do we have around leakage, either value or liquidity, so things like that. So we'll certainly take all of that into account. And we've left a deal or we've walked away from a deal for any number of those reasons. Maybe pricing just got to our pain point or our indifference point. Oftentimes it's around covenants. Typically 95% of our deals have financial covenants. So it's rare that we allow there to be no covenants. And so there's certainly times when the terms just get too tight. And again, I think that kind of harks back to the fact that we don't have that pressure to put money to work. Right? We look at it as we're investing capital.
Within the core middle market that you're focused on, are you perhaps seeing more distress or special situations opportunities come your way given the recent market volatility?
I'd say yes and no. We do have within Bain Capital a whole special situations business that's slightly bigger than the private credit business. But to your point, you know, even within the private credit business, about 80% of our portfolio is senior, but 20% is junior. And that junior is really targeted towards less distressed companies per se, more good company, bad balance sheet type situation. So you might have had a company that grew a lot in the last couple, 3 years, used a lot of debt to fuel acquisitions. Now with a slowdown is finding a tough time digesting some of those acquisitions. And so they need to release some of that pressure on the senior so we could come in and put in a junior capital deal that might pay down that senior and take some of the pressure off there. So that is an area where we actually will potentially offer PIK interest as an option to ease the liquidity burden on that company as well. You know, as far as whether there's more of that now, yeah, there's definitely more of that today than there was, for example, last year. I think there's going to be even more in about 6 months when there's a lot more clarity about where the economy is going. You know, today it's really hard to forecast that.
You touched on covenants too. I know it's a little bit different between the syndicated market and the private credit market, but are you observing any shifts in borrower or sponsor expectations when it comes to covenants? Should we expect to see perhaps looser or tighter covenants than what we have now?
It's a fair question. I'll tell you, sponsors always are optimistic they can get a deal with no covenants, of course. What I would say is in this core middle market segment where we reside, again, $25 to $75 million of EBITDA, it is much more likely than not that we can get a covenant. And part of that is driven by the fact that if you start getting to bigger deals, $75, $150 million deals, you often see a club being formed and you've got maybe a handful of lenders. And if you have a $3 billion unitranche, it ends up being, you know, 20 different lenders. That becomes a little bit more akin to the broadly syndicated market where the lowest common denominator wins. Once one of those people caves, then everyone else kind of has to cave. In our case, two-thirds to three-quarters of our deals are ones where we have the majority of the tranche, so we're driving the documentation, and there's no fringe players that are going to cave in that sense. And so we are pretty adamant about ensuring that we have covenants. I've been doing this at Bain Capital for over 25 years now, and you know, we're talking about tariffs now. You can talk about the interest rate bubble a couple of years ago. You talk about COVID. You can go back to the GFC. There's been a dozen other little mini crises in different industries over the last 25 years too. And if there's one thing we've learned, it's these are not liquid loans. And so we need to ensure that we have some sort of goalposts that protect us as lenders if performance does not come anywhere near management's plan. And that really takes the form of covenants. And so that's an area where we just won't compromise.
And I know you mentioned before the threshold on the deal size, that the threshold for including covenants in private credit deals has shifted from 75 to 100 million down to $50 million. Is this trend still continuing? Or are we still seeing this?
Yeah, look, I think we're holding the line there. I think the you're still getting covenants on some bigger deals, 75 million plus, if there's a little bit more story to the credit, if it's a challenging industry niche, if it's got a difficult past for whatever reason. You know, an example might be you're an aerospace supplier and even supplying to Boeing. Ordinarily, that would be a fine, steady business. But with some of the noise around the 737 MAX and production going way down at Boeing, you get a little more noise now with China slowing down orders, although it's not a big part of Boeing's order book. You could think you're in a perfectly comfortable position as that company. All of a sudden, these exogenous factors end up impacting you. So if you're a large provider there, we might put some tighter covenants on you to make sure that you come out of the Boeing restart effectively pretty well. So you are still seeing some bigger deals that have covenants too, but yeah, below 50 million, it's really hard for us to give on that. And I think that's true across the market.
Do you think that 50 million threshold is here to stay, or is it more like a temporary shift?
I would prefer to push it up, of course, right? But no, I don't think it's, I think that movement happened, you know, probably 5-10 years ago, even pre-COVID. So I feel pretty comfortable about that level staying there.
And how does that compare to syndicated deals?
I mean, syndicated deals, I think it's the other way, where 90% of those are covenant light. And so that's why there's so much more pressure at the upper end of the middle market, because if you are a borrower, your choice is always between some of these newer private credit players that have those ungodly amounts of money, or the broadly syndicated loan market. One of the differentiators is kind of certainty to close, really, because with a private credit lender, you've got maybe a handful of people who will speak for most of the deal. You know it's closed. You have to go through a syndication process and everything else. You might have a delayed draw term loan option. You might have a PIK interest option for part of it. So it's all those things that you're probably choosing between. But the private credit deals at that level are going covenant light too.
Speaking of the competition, I guess, between the BSL market and the private credit market, mm-hmm. We've recently seen the syndicated market has been largely frozen in the past few weeks, given all the tariff announcements. Are we seeing more interest in private credit given the slowdown in the syndicated market? Do you think it'll take up a share?
So look, the slowdown in the syndicated market a couple, 3 years ago is really what drove the development of this upper middle market private credit space, because there was no other option really for large companies to get financing. Broadly syndicated loan market then certainly came back over the last year, 18 months, and that has really wreaked some havoc, I think, with some of the upper middle market deals there. You're right, lately in the last couple of weeks, there's certainly been less syndicated deals. Now, I think there's also less deal activity. So it's not like there's 27 deals that are all of a sudden being abandoned by the syndicated market, the private credit market could jump into now. It's just M&A has largely slowed down as well. So I think there's a little bit of TBD, but we've seen this dynamic before, where there's certainly ebbs and flows between the broadly syndicated loan market and the private credit market. You know, ultimately, the broadly syndicated loan market is dependent on CLO formation. That's the biggest buyer of broadly syndicated loans. So I think it's always interesting to look at the level of CLO warehousing that's going on, because that's going to portend a later CLO issuance. And I think that's been certainly on the slower side. Having said that, we actually just priced a broadly syndicated CLO 2 days ago. So even in this market turmoil, there is still new CLO formation, which therefore means there is new broadly syndicated loan interest.
Has the private credit activity slowed down in the past few weeks?
I think it would slow down even going back to into the first quarter, when there started being a lot of concern about what the tariff announcement was going to be. Clearly, when Liberation Day happened a few weeks ago, and tariffs were larger than expected, I think everyone from Chairman Powell on down has expressed surprise at the extent of those tariffs, right? And I think that's really put a lot of pause on some deals. So if I think about deal activity right now. There were a few deals that were very close to the finish line. Those are still getting over the finish line. There's some new screens that we've had where we're just starting to look at a company where we've been informed either the deal has been pulled by the seller or the sponsor or two or three that we're looking at it with have all bowed out. So I think there's a little bit of a pause right now. I mean, there's a little bit of the, if you're trying to get a deal done right now, you must be really desperate. So what are we missing? Right. So I think everyone's kind of putting a pause on new deal activity right now.
What do you think it's going to take for the markets to unlock?
Great question. I would tell you certainty either way, right? Is it going to be 175% tariffs on China? Is it not going to be 175% tariffs on China? Lower is better in my estimation. But the point more broadly is without some level of certainty, it's much harder for us to forecast because it's much harder for companies to figure out where they want to make investments and CapEx dollars and hiring. Oh, should we be introducing a RIF because we're concerned more about a recession at this point? So that uncertainty, I think, is really what's building it. Because once you have certainty, you can model that in and you can try to forecast that. Unfortunately, I'm a little afraid that certainty is not a strong suit in the US right now, because again, you wake up every morning and there could be a different tweet. I mean, right now the tariffs are on pause, except for with China. So, you know, we'll see what happens in 80 something days at this point.
Do you think we will see a longer term recalibration of, you know, how investors think about risk and what returns they expect in private credit, given everything that's going on?
Yeah, so the investor base is really got tuned into private credit when base rates were so low for so long. It's a fixed income product, right? It's a fixed income floating rate product. And so we are often comped against other floating rate investments. Could be treasuries. It could be the broadly syndicated loan market, et cetera. So as long as we're providing a premium to that and the investor can stomach illiquidity, I think it's a very attractive asset class. Being in a first lien position is particularly attractive. So when base rates were so low for so long, you saw a lot of investors frustrated with what yields were available in the liquid markets, and so they started realizing they could tie up some of their capital and get illiquid returns. I don't think that's gone away on the one hand. On the other hand, what's been interesting is with base rates having gotten so high now, and you now almost pricing deals in the 12, 14% gross range, private credit's actually become interesting to a different set of investors who are looking at it more from a fixed rate perspective. What can I get here versus private equity, for example, because that's also a liquid. And when we're able to deliver 12 to 14% type returns, all of a sudden that's really attractive. I think that's temporary because base rates were so high for a bit and that started to abate a little bit already. But I think that core investor who's looking for a fixed income like return is going to be there. And it used to just be institutions, insurance companies may have been opened up to this asset class. You've seen retail grow in this asset class as well. So I think it's definitely become an established asset class. I think it's here to stay.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Mike, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Melanie.
And thank you to our listeners for checking out this episode of Debt Wired. As always, you can subscribe or download every episode via Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at DebtWired.com. See you next time.